Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome back to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is the Progeny speaking, and I'm also joined today by the Patriarch, as per usual. Thank goodness this time we're not going to be accompanied by the Do-Nothing Brothers. In our last episode, they managed to kind of come along and...
Hi, Jack.
Yes, that's about the right word. By the time I was finished with that episode, I was thinking it was going to be one of our all-time worst, but I have been hearing various things out in the ether. Anyway.
On the interweb.
It has been several weeks since we last recorded, and all sorts of things have been happening. We're coming into that season of anticipation as everyone lines up and gets ready to go to see Star Wars. Which I have seen now, and I don't have to stalk the dark corners of the internet hoping that no one will spoil it for me, avoiding the mainstream, but the Patriarch has not
seen it.
Yes, he is boycotting it. I'm not entirely sure why. Why are you boycotting the movie?
I don't know why. I don't know. I'm just thumbing my nose at
commercialism. That's what
well,
it is.
Well, it's cultural peer pressure.
I think that could basically be your motto in life. You know,
it might be my motto.
If something is popular,
yeah.
Too many people start to like something.
There's a few exceptions to that, but that's generally true.
Mm. Yep, Lord of the Rings is your Star Wars. On that occasion, but even then, you know, there will be no camping, there will be no dressing for premieres, at least for the Patriarch, though I and my two siblings did dress to go to the premiere, the second day in a small town in Virginia, and so we were the only ones dressed up, but, you know, YOLO.
Yeah. There okay. You have it. That's the exact, that is the problem with...
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't think
YOLO.
I don't think I've ever used YOLO in a sentence before. I feel liberated.
Yeah.
I feel like I am, you know...
I feel like a failure as a parent.
You know that meme that goes around with Christopher Walken saying, "Hello, fellow kids"? I mean, because that's basically me.
No, I don't know what he's... What's the guy from, what's the other Christopher from Sound of Music?
Plumber.
When you said that, for some reason, I was thinking Christopher Plummer said it. I was like, why would he say that?
Yeah.
But when you say Christopher Walken says it, it makes perfect sense, because he would say creepy things like that.
I'm still not over the fact that Christopher Plummer didn't sing Edelweiss. I mean, that was just kind of the end of my childhood. Speaking of end of
he
your...
He would have had a chance to sing it in the new country, or the new world. The new world.
Yeah, poor fella. He hated Terrence Malick after that movie, because... you know, Terrence Malick has a habit of cutting people completely out of his movies.
He should have let him sing in it. He should have let him sing Edelweiss and then cut that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're referencing my favorite movie, which we ought to have reviewed back at Thanksgiving because it was about Pocahontas.
Kind of.
You know, it's a little bit historically inaccurate, just a little bit.
When you watch it with the progeny, she says, "Now this means this. Now that means that. Now, this means this over
it's
here.
It's a metaphor.
Right.
Yeah, it's all symbolic and stuff. Speaking of things which are not symbolic.
I'm thinking, well, that means the Indians are, you know, beginning to attack.
You're like, it looks like lightning to me. And I'm like, it's foreshadowing. It means their relationship is crumbling. Something
yeah,
is going
like
to go
lightning
wrong.
It's to me.
It's, yeah. So.
You notice how they keep moving inward and into the country?
Oh, yeah, like, that was.
Like, well, that's what they do. Where else are they going to go?
Yes, well, I mean, the camera is, anyway. But speaking of movies that don't have too much symbolic meaning, that would be the new Star Wars movie, which we are not going to spoil for you, because
I can't.
Yes, because the
I could make up something.
Well, you know, I thought it was a good movie until they shaved Chewbacca. But, anyway.
Then he looked like one of the hairless chihuahuas.
And then you found out, of course, that Luke and Han were really long-lost brothers, and that was pretty shocking.
No, that would be awkward.
It was already awkward enough, what with Luke and Leia being brother and sister. But I actually went with a friend who had never seen a single Star Wars movie in her life, so it was very entertaining to. Well, it
they're
was,
out there.
Yeah,
we have a guy at our office that hasn't seen all of them, and he's 20.
Well, this person, you know, so the main villain walks onto the screen, and she says, "Is that Darth Vader?" I'm like, "No, Darth Vader's dead." "Is he? Darth Vader's dead? I didn't know that. Whose father was he?" "He's always, I see on the internet," and I'm like, "Oh gosh, please, how do I, you know, I did not know exactly how to cope with that." Anyway, but.
So she's a well-adjusted young woman, I imagine.
Yeah, pretty well-adjusted.
Yeah.
You don't need to see Star Wars to have a well-adjusted life, but you are going to miss out on a lot of cultural references.
Yeah, and I'm glad you didn't say important cultural references.
Anyway, we are not going to be talking about Star Wars, however, today, because we are going to be talking about a Christmas movie, which is not Die Hard, because everybody thinks it's funny when you say Die Hard whenever people bring up Christmas movies. But we're going to be talking about A Christmas Story.
Hey, well, before that, you know, you've got to talk about, The Weekly Standard.
Oh, that. Yeah, I've kind of been sitting on that one for like 2 or 3 months now. I haven't mentioned it on the podcast because I wasn't entirely sure that it would happen and that I wasn't in some sort of happy dream.
Why don't you tell the story?
So, several months ago, back when it was still warm outside and the leaves were on the trees, I was on Twitter because that's what you do when it's warm outside and the leaves are on the trees. And I ended up chatting with John Podhoretz, who is a writer and film critic for the Weekly Standard, on Twitter about a TV show called Broadchurch. Some of you have seen that. It's terrific. I highly recommend it. It was the best TV show of 2013. Don't watch the second season. But we ended up chatting about that, and I shared my reviews of the second season, and he complimented them, which, you know, tickled me to no end, and at that moment, I had come to a crossroads, and I knew what my father would tell me to do, as he always tells me to do whenever something like that, you know, comes up. He says,
"Use the Force."
"Offer them your resume." And I'm like, you know, this is crazy. This is a terrible idea. Why am I doing this? But I said, hey, you know, if you need somebody to write for the Weekly Standard sometime, do some TV reviews, you know, I'm completely willing to take time out of my busy schedule to do a little bit of that. And lo and behold, I get a message on Twitter from one of the editors, Richard Starr, and he refers me to the literary editor, Philip Terzian, and it kind of snowballed from there, and I ended up writing an article about Twin Peaks and The X-Files, which are two 90s cult classics that are being renewed in the spring, I believe. Now, well, Twin Peaks is going to come out much later. It's being filmed right now, but I ended up writing an article for them, and it has just been published, and I am sharing it all over my social media locations, and I am very excited about it. So
she's plotting her next move.
Yes. How do I next make my next move in my?
To leverage that, and you start have to step it on people and moving on up.
Yes.
It's
going
to be
huge.
It's
I mean, I'm good at this business. I am fantastic. I'm the classiest. I mean,
it's
this podcast.
So classy.
Yes. This podcast may be the most unorganized on the internet. It might be, you know, but I mean, even if we should shut down the internet, but it is definitely the classiest. So anyway, you know, two big things. That was a pretty big deal. I've been writing for Summit Ministries for about a month now too, which is also pretty cool for me because, you know, I'm actually, you know, it's actually kind of a job, you know.
Kind of it is, yes.
It's kind of a job, you know, and I like having a job. I had never had anything published before that piece in any publication, strictly speaking. Well, the Summit Ministry stuff, I started writing for them after I began corresponding with the Weekly Standard, but So, anyway, we had probably better get back on topic now. We are talking about A Christmas Story. Now, get the ball rolling. When did you first watch A Christmas Story? What's your story there?
My mother and father had one of the early satellite dishes in this area that was about the size of, the Superdome. You would have these enormous satellite dishes out in the yard, and they would. I mean, it was so early. I don't know exactly how or why we ended up with one so early, but back in those days, you could get any channel. I mean, you could get anything that was coming down off a satellite, and none of it was scrambled, none of it was encrypted, and so you could watch. I think they had HBO and just any of the other cable network, programming that you could get. And so I'm pretty sure that's the first time I saw it was there, because I don't remember, because it was like Christmas all every day. You got all these. We went from having like one television channel to having 50. But I saw it there first. Then I went to college and I introduced it to my college roommates. I remember that, because we'd all sit down and just hoot and holler over it, and keep the references from the movie around. So, but it was, immediately. I don't remember the first time I saw it, but it didn't go away. It wasn't something I knew that it was really something special.
I don't remember the first time I would have watched it. I mean, it would have been years ago. It's really just something that's pretty ubiquitous throughout my youth. But it's definitely a film which I can see why people are nostalgic about it. It's something which is simultaneously nostalgic and cynical, I think, which we'll get into
cynical.
In a minute.
Cynical?
Well, we'll get into that in a minute, but I want to kind of give a little bit of a biography of the film. It's based on a book by Gene Shepard called In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Gene Shepard was a radio announcer in the years following, radio humorist and announcer in the years following World War II, and just would kind of ramble on about his life and about things, and just, and a bunch of these were short stories which were published in various places in which he read on the air. He also narrates the movie, and co-wrote it. You can definitely tell that whoever the narrator is somebody who's very used and very relaxed to just, while narrating. But that's really possibly the best part of the movie, is just the narration. It's one of the great voiceovers of all time.
Yeah.
But anyway, Shepard invented the stories, but the story of Christmas Story does take place in a location very similar to his hometown. So it's only kind of vaguely autobiographical. A few names he took from people he knew. Schwartz, for instance, I think was a real person. The four of the short stories in the book form the basis for the movie, which is Jewel in the Snow, The Counterfeit Secret Circle Member Gets the Message, My Old Man and the Lascivious Special Award That Heralded the Birth of Pop Art, and Grover Dill and the Tasmanian Devil. So the movie came out in 1983. It was a week before Thanksgiving, and it really wasn't all that successful, just kind of...
I graduated from high school in 1983, so that's interesting.
It's the reviews were just kind of fair to middling. Roger Ebert, he kind of liked it, but he the New York Times panned it.
Of course.
But
why would they want to get anything right for a change?
Roger Ebert explains it by saying that most people didn't go to holiday themed movies at the time. These days you get two or three every year, so it's that's a little bit bizarre. But later on, of course, as it moved on to video and further, it became much more popular, and now, of course, it's a Christmas classic. Eventually, it inspired a sequel. Did you know there was a sequel?
No.
Yes, there was. And it came out in 1997, I think, but of course they had to recast everything, so... And the cast, they replaced the entire cast except for Ted Teddy Moore, I think that's how you pronounce her first name, Ralphie's teacher, and it was called It Runs in the Family, and it was later renamed My Summer Story. As Ralphie, you're going to recognize a few of these names. Ralphie was played by Kieran Culkin, who was one of the brothers of Macaulay Culkin. Apparently, the Christmas child classic thing Runs in the Family. His younger brother Randy was played by Christian Culkin, and the parents were played by Mary Steenburgen, who is actually James Caan's wife in Elf, another Christmas movie connection, and one of the more interesting cast selections for me was Charles Grodin plays the father.
Really?
Yes, and that, I have very little interest in seeing it besides that, but there's a little part of me that really wants to see him play Ralphie.
What's it called?
My Summer Story. I watched a clip from it, and it's interesting because the feel of it, it's clunkier. It doesn't really have a very good MacGuffin. The MacGuffin in this movie is the Red Ryder BB gun. In that movie, it's Tops for some reason. That was not a great choice. Gene Shepard's narration was still superb because he was involved in that movie as well, but it just felt a little bit strange. And there was a very brief clip of Charles Grodin playing Ralphie's dad. We know Chuck Grodin from various David Letterman appearances and, of course, from one of our favorite movies, Midnight Run, which is nothing at all like A Christmas Story. is a nice little character drama, kind of a road trip buddy movie, a few shootouts and things like that. Anyway, I guess we should summarize the movie. What's the movie about?
So I guess that the sequel bombed.
The sequel was not. Yeah, it was like a TV movie maybe actually I think it was in theaters, but it did not do very well.
Right.
So
that's hard to. Yeah, that would be that would be a hard act to follow. By the time it had its hooks into the pop culture of America,
it's partly difficult because the setting of this film is so very particular to Christmas. If you're going to move it away, you have mm-hmm. to find an event which has similar power for a child in that particular era, mm-hmm. and they just couldn't find it.
Interesting.
But anyway, this movie is about a little boy named Ralphie Parker who wants a BB gun for Christmas. However, the world is conspiring against his wishes, and especially his mother, who seems to be leading the attack on Red Ryder and his gang of merry men. And so Ralphie just can't seem to get this item for Christmas, and nobody will agree to get it for him. Help me out here. That's basically the plot. It's his journey to try and achieve this goal.
I guess you could say that's the plot, but that's certainly not the story.
Yeah, that's true. There are also a bunch of subplots that go off in different directions and involve a variety of entertaining side characters, which we'll get into. Which would you say was your favorite of those side characters?
You mean outside the family?
Yeah. Well, maybe, probably, in the family, too. I mean, because my favorite would definitely be the old man.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, within the family, yeah, I agree. I mean, outside the family, I don't know. There's so many. I mean, everybody's just cartoonish. It's so funny and so well done. You got Scott Farkas and,
Schwartz is pretty great.
Schwartz is great. Even the Santa Claus.
The workaholic Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you once wrote an article for our local paper that kind of drew from this and slightly kind of, and this is one of the themes I want to talk about first, which is just anticipation. The primary emotion in this story is anticipation of Christmas is coming, and just, when you're a kid, that is the big day. It is D-Day. This is when everything that you've been waiting for is going to come true. So what does that have anything to do with Christmas? you know, what does that have to do with, you know, we're going to try and, again, you know, this is, it is a Christmas movie, so. What does that have to do with the original Christmas anyway?
Oh, that Christmas.
I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a whole different, A Christmas Story is the personification or the stand-in for the what Americans think Christmas should be about and is about. Because there's really no, there, you know, you mentioned that on the, she showed me this little thing on Home Alone the other day about.
Oh yeah, that's great.
And at least in the Home Alone, there was some nod to the true meaning of Christmas, which is the birth of Jesus. But you don't get any of that in A Christmas Story. It's complete commercialism and American ideals. It's very endearing because families are all important and growing up. I mean, it's really more of kind of a coming of age story in a lot of ways, and growing up, and there's one or two things that I guess don't fit too well with that. But you know, it's he absolutely nails the kind of the especially when I was and I can't, I don't know if that applies today. Probably does somewhat, but when I was growing up, you know, like you just said, at Christmas everything was just, you know, this hyper excitement about Christmas, and the he really hits all the buttons. He hits the Christmas parade. He hits the, you know, when I was growing up, I'd look at the wish book from Sears and Roebuck, but you know, Ralphie, they look in the window of the shop. There's the meal that goes with it. There's going to see Santa Claus and the big stores and the bustling people and what's going on in school, you know. And so he really just paints an almost perfect picture of what that was like to kind of experience that Christmas, that very secular or American version of Christmas. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's a definite universality to the story, which is basically why it's so popular. It, especially to Americans, it feels,
yes.
A lot of the story details I can't resonate with. I mean, I was homeschooled. I didn't walk to school with people like that. I didn't, but I've experienced those dynamics between kids, you know, arguing and daring each other to do stuff and, you know, the bravado and the cowardice and the avarice and all those things. And that's one of my favorite things about it, is that the kids are so unromanticized. There's nothing romantic about the vision of these kids. It's
that's
utterly
true.
Realistic. You know, kids are very greedy.
Yes.
And kids are completely convinced that they're the center of the universe.
and conniving and scheming. I mean, you know, has anyone seen, what's his name? Has anyone seen Flick? Flick?
Flick?
Flick? Who's Flick?
Yes. You know, yep.
You know.
Ralphie is no hero, and that's interesting because normally, I mean, you have some, Ralphie is at base, he's not going to put himself out of his comfort zone in order to save anybody except Ralphie.
I think the thing that he does the best, I think, in the movie is that he lets you see the world through a 10-year-old's eyes. You know, the parents are really cartoonish, right? I mean, they're really, the only time that they really are adults is at the very end of the movie when the kids are in bed and they're down there looking out the window at the snowfall. That's the only time, I think, in the movie that they're really allowed to be adults. The rest of the time, they're seen through the eyes of Ralphie, which is, you know, they're just completely over the top.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, everything is exaggerated. Everything is much bigger than it actually
yeah,
is.
Exactly.
It's you know, if you get into a fight at school, your father is going to come home and he is going to kill you.
Yes.
I mean, literally, he is literally going
he's
to kill you.
He's going to kill Ralphie.
Yes, he's going to kill Ralphie, and he, you know, you're going to get soap poisoning. You know, because you're punished this one time. You know, all of these events are just seen through this huge lens. Everything is huge.
Well, and like the award that his dad gets, you know, now that, you know, I mean, it's a cartoon because who in the world would have a leg lamp, right? But you could almost imagine that he won something else. That he won something else and just really took it to heart, you know, and through a 10-year-old's eyes, it's like, you got to be kidding.
Well, you know, I think that there's, to some extent, you have an unreliable narrator. You know, things are seem more melodramatic than they are, and Ralphie fantasizes about things, and the Red Ryder BB gun is coated in this glow.
Right.
But I'm not so sure about the parents. I mean, I think that I think Ralphie's dad is very interesting to observe because he's kind of a role model for Ralphie, and they both tend to see the world in a very similar light. They share a sense that they struggle contra mundum. They have this kind of quixotic sense of heroism, and everything is turned into an epic struggle. You know, and his father is exactly the same way as Ralphie is about that. You know, everything is a battle. It's the, you know, when he goes down to fight that furnace, it is, you know, you could see the light of battle come into his eyes. When he has to change the tires, he's in the pits, and he's in there changing those tires, and it's a race against time. Everything is fit into a narrative of struggle, and that's I think a lot of Ralphie picks up on that. He too is the hero in his own personal story, and they kind of have this sense of destiny, you know. And that's something you don't see quite as much anymore, I think. You know, just I don't know. It's just this was a segment of American.
And you think about it as the you know, Ralphie, he tries to talk his mom into the BB gun, right?
Yeah.
He tries to talk his teacher into the BB gun. He tries to talk Santa into the BB gun. It never really occurs to him to approach his dad, right?
Yeah.
And so, it was such a neat moment at the end where you think, oh, of course, you know, of course his dad would, it would be from his dad because his dad would understand and would know, they have that connection as to, that he would recognize how much it's, you know, in other words, he's not completely oblivious to what Ralphie and what's his brother's name?
Randy.
Ralphie and Randy are, you know, what their lives are like. So,
you know, and I think that, and I really love the parents in this. They are, I mean, they're so messed up, you know, because she spoils the kids, and he gets annoyed by it, and that dynamic is something that I've seen so many times, just in real parents, you know. They have different parenting techniques. They're trying to do those things, and they're you know, inconsistent with punishment, and just they seem like a real family. And little things like how at the end when he finally gives Ralphie the BB gun, he looks at her, and she's just glaring at him, and he just kind of just melts a little bit, and he's like, I had one when I was 8 years old. You know, he knows exactly what she's thinking, and he's like, I'm trying to,
yeah,
and he's trying his best to appease her, and it's it all feels so real, and I think that is really partly most of the charm of the movie is just that it all the characters are quite convinced of who they are, and they know what their place in the universe is, and that's
yeah, I mean, they've got it's a real accurate view of, well, maybe accurate's the wrong word, but it, because it's maybe it's somewhat idealized, but, you know, everybody kind of thinks that the moms that stayed home homes in the 50s and 60s or whatever, 40s, just led completely terrible lives. You know, they were just practically enslaved. But you know, there's just a sweetness to it. The whole thing is like that she's taking care of the two little guys and the dad's out doing battle with the world, trying to, you know, scrape by. He's not climbing any kind of career ladder, and you know, and so she's not missing anything there, and he's obviously not capable of handling the kids 24 hours a day. So it's just this wonderful.
Well, there's this sense too that she kind of indulges his delusions of grandeur.
Yes.
You know, it's
the worst lamp I have seen in my entire life.
Yes. And it just works so well, you know. She just kind of, lets him go on believing that he's this amazing, you know, major award-winning.
Well, that he's going to change the tire in 3 minutes, like they do at the Indy 500, you know.
Yep.
Tommy.
Yeah, and it's so that's all great, you know.
But they have this really, even though they've got that. You know, they're just, it's that there's no tension in the marriage. I mean, even though they're arguing and going at each other some, you know, there's this sense of that they're all in it together, and it's really comforting. You know, in other words, Rena Ralphie never really worries about his parents separating. You know, that would be something, you know, much darker, but.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking about it kind of this time around, trying to think, okay, if this was a real family, what sort of effects would this or that have? And I was thinking, okay, if the whole thing over the lamp, you know, he just looks furious, you know, and if it was in real life, he wouldn't have talked to her for 2 weeks. But you know, after they'd kind of gloss it over, and everybody moves on.
Yes.
And so there's the sense that Ralphie remembers the fights more than he does kind of the more tender moments between them, like the last moment is something which he doesn't see. I don't know, but it this is the style of it is something which is somewhat accessible to me, and yet also somewhat dated. It's very Norman Rockwell-esque. It feels like Rockwell, but if you kind of got down into the dirty, gritty side of the people in those paintings, you know, this is the way they would talk, and this is the way they would act, and this is the way they would
I agree with that.
Discipline their children, and so on and so forth. So
I agree with that.
And it's kind of a snapshot of that period in American life too. It's supposed to be ambiguously somewhere between the 30s and the 40s, not specific to certain year.
That's right. And again, I mean, it's a much simpler time. In a way, don't you think? I mean,
yeah. You know, I was thinking they couldn't make a movie these days about a kid who wanted a gun for Christmas. You know, I don't. I mean, maybe not even a BB gun. It's just not as ubiquitous as it used to be.
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I wonder if the studios would even entertain the idea. You know, of that. Now they might just because of the Christmas Story, you know, that you might recognize the hypocrisy there, but if it hadn't been for that, I seriously doubt they would.
You know, yeah, and of course at the same time, we're
too much back.
We have American cinema has such a schizophrenia about guns. I mean, guns are everywhere in the movie. So you know, every hero has to prove himself by wielding a gun in some way. You have that on the screen, and yet yet guns were supposed to be just absolutely terrified of owning one in real life.
You'll shoot your eye out. Yeah, and you know, the argument against the gun in that movie is you'll shoot your eye out versus, you know, that they're the cornerstone of all that's wrong with violence in America.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very personal objection, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody's mother is going to say that at some point anyway. You know, you can't do that. You know, you're gonna kill yourself. You know, so
I had when I was 8 years old.
Yeah. But of course, you know, Ralphie does, in the end, nearly shoot his eye out.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we all have this sinking feeling in the back of our minds that our parents may be right about things. Just like, you know, me with the Weekly Standard, you know, I found out that you were right. I should offer my resume to every single person on Twitter from now on, and that's what I'm going to do.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm just going to start doing that. I might, you know, even start doing that when I meet people.
Oh, or even like, I don't know, on a podcast.
Yes. You know, anybody out there that needs to employ me.
And if you want to send any leads.
If you want to pay anything more than $0. Yeah, so, Ralphie. He's part of the story is Ralphie never quite breaks out of his fantasies. It's a very small segment of this boy's life. But at the same time, he once he gets what he has wanted for the entire movie, it's kind of a letdown, you know. He doesn't go outside and kill a bunch of villains. He goes out and then manages to break his glasses, you know, and nearly actually shoot his eye out. So, I mean, what does that theme kind of add to the story? What is?
I don't know. It was just, I don't know if it was, I guess it was just intended to be funny and humorous. You know, it's one of those things, I guess, like you're right, is that it was playing back that his parents might have known what they were talking about there a little bit too, right? And that was kind of one of the fears. I mean, any kind of a Christmas present, almost without exception, lets you down.
Well, pretty much anything you achieve, anything you get, once you get to the top of that mountain.
Yeah.
You know,
but I remember that a little bit from when I was growing up. Is you'd get this toy maybe that you really really wanted, and then, oh, you know, well, it really doesn't do this, and it really doesn't do that, and so it's not really as great as I thought in my mind that it was going to be. And maybe that was a little bit in play there, but I think it was just meant to be funny, you know, but.
I listened to the recording of Gene Shepard reading the story on the air, and it was an abridged version of the story, but he ended it, and that was the ending, was Ralphie nearly shooting his eye out, and he just had this horror in his voice. My parents had been right all along.
Really?
And,
okay.
And he just goes off, he's like, what if my parents were right about everything? You know, my child, yeah, world was shaken. And it was very funny, but, you know, he's like, he says, they're right. He says, the establishment is right when they tell you don't drink and drive, listen. And it's just, he's just going all melodramatically about all this. And, you know, and there are actually quite a few recordings of his radio stuff online. You guys should check them out sometime. I'll add a link to that particular one in the show notes. But, yeah, it's just this... all throughout the movie, it's kind of a contrast between the sort of sentimentality and then cynicism about this child's avarice. You know, you're thinking, oh yeah, I remember when I wanted Christmas presents like that, but yeah, wasn't I a greedy little sucker?
Yeah, we all are.
And of course, Ralphie somewhat gets his comeuppance, but he wheedles his way out of that. You know,
yeah.
And of course, the way that every child has at some point or another. And there's no sense, I think, in this movie. There's not a really a moral story arc.
No.
You know, Ralphie doesn't learn that it's wrong to lie or anything.
No.
Which is kind of interesting. I don't know. I mean,
it's just a romp. I mean, it's just like you said, Norman Rockwell. It's just filling in and letting you relive what it's like to be 10 years old again.
And there is a self-awareness of Ralphie's flaws. I mean, he doesn't learn anything.
Yeah,
and when
you're 10, your world looks a lot differently, and the response. You know, you never know what his dad works at, and you know, and they never talk about the bills they got to pay and all that. You know, all that stuff.
You know, if there was a war going on, Ralphie wouldn't have known it. You know, he's got his very specific set of, you know, interests, and this is what is happening in Ralphie's world, and that's all.
In Ralphie's world, it's what's going on at school, and it's the local bully, and it's getting that gun for Christmas.
Orphan Annie.
Little Orphan Annie, right.
Yep. There's another example of being let down. You know, he's got all this anticipation building up to this thing which is going to complete his life, and then it's a crummy advertisement.
Yeah, and so I think I mentioned earlier, it really is kind of a coming of age story a little bit. I mean, you know, he has to handle the bully, the little orphan Annie thing. It's not really clear if he really buys into the Santa Claus thing or not, you know.
Yeah, well, of course, Santa, as it turns out, is, you know, somewhat, he's not as idealized either. Once you get to Santa, Santa is absolutely terrifying in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and really puts you into the mind of a child, too.
Right.
The camera, you know, him zooming in back and forth, and it's like, oh my goodness. And I remember just being terrified of certain people like that when I was a kid. I was like, okay.
The camera angle there, like when they spin it around, you know, and you're going up on the...
Yeah, you feel dizzy and nauseous.
It's just like a kid, you know.
Yeah, you're being picked up. I have no power over myself. What's going on here?
And then what do you want for Christmas? How about a football? Yeah, that sounds good.
Football?
Yeah.
Football. It's a football. you know, and an interesting thing is that this movie does not have... beyond Scott Farkas, really, and Scott Farkas, I guess, would be it. But the there is no antagonist with the story of Ralphie's struggle to attain the BB gun. His mother seems like she would be the antagonist from the start of the movie, but she's not. You know, it's a way in which he's trying to talk her into it, but she's not a villain. You know, there are so many movies that turn the parents into the villains, you know, for not letting the child have whatever, you know.
And he doesn't try to talk her out of it either.
Yeah.
Except that he puts the magazines on her bed and stuff, you know.
You know, little passive-aggressive ways.
Yeah.
And so Ralphie's parents, if they hadn't gotten him that BB gun, would have still been his parents and he would have gotten over it. You know, it was something that he didn't entirely blame them for. It was something he kind of had to achieve that for himself. He had to sort of earn it, you know, in a way. And that was nice. It's Roger Ebert. He describes them. He says that he thinks they're about the nicest movie parents he's seen in ages. And he also, and this I thought was kind of an interesting theory. He says that he thinks the old man in the scene right after the Scott Farkas affair has gone down. Ralphie walks downstairs convinced that he's going to die, and his mother sort of casually mentions it to the father.
Mm-hmm.
And Ebert says that his theory is that the father knew all along what had happened, you know, and I don't know whether that means that either the parents planned how they were going to handle it when Ralphie came down together, you know, and or whether he knew all along and he was just, you know, okay, she's downplaying it, I'll react to that, you know. I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that theory.
Well, you know, when she says, well, you know how boys will be or something like that, he knows how boys will be. You know, he knows that there's going to be fights and he's you know, that he, it's like it's no big deal to him.
Yeah.
You know, because of the way she presented it to him. If she had been upset about it, then he would have been upset about it.
Yeah, if she had framed it as Ralphie just jumped on this kid, you know, and just beat the living daylights out of him, which is all she saw as happening, you know, because frankly, I think that if he knew anything about Scott Farkas, he would have been on Ralphie's side, you know, because that is the sort of thing that he is doing in a less dramatic way in his life all the time. He's got this some sort of, you know, battle against something at all times. I called him quixotic earlier, and that's, I think, a pretty good word for it. It's just everything. You know, the Bumpus's dogs. Every time he goes in, he's got to yell at the Bumpus's dogs. He gets some joy out of it, I think. You know, another thing about the family, and the family is really the heart of the story, is just their interactions. They just feel so real. But they're also thoroughly unreconstructed. That was something you mentioned. It's just they're not politically correct in any sense of the word. This movie isn't trying to reinvent anything.
Yeah, it's not trying. It's not trying to.
There are very few families on screen, I think, that really convince you that they are a family.
Right.
You
know, point. Yeah,
even the kid Randy, and I thought the kid Randy was terrific. He was just there being a kid. There was no acting at all.
Well, I wouldn't say that because he pulled off the piggy thing really, really remarkably well.
Yeah, I suspect that she was able to kind of psych him up to that.
I know, but if you think, I was watching this last time we watched it, is that, you know, he does the little trough thing, right?
And
the food smeared all over his face, and what happens next? There's a knock on the door. And when there's the knock on the door, with the major award being over, everybody stops, and the camera goes to Randy, and he stops laughing, you know, and giggling, and he's bought in too. He's like, you know, it's here.
Immediately.
Yeah, immediately. And it's actually a very good, I don't know how they
did it. Well, you're right, you know, he could flip that switch, you know.
Yeah.
And the scene when he's under the cupboard, and he's in the cupboard, he's daddy's gonna kill Ralphie.
And he goes into the, you know, he's running into the bathroom stuff. And I know all that's little stuff, but he could have been, if that had been handled a little bit differently, it could have ruined almost the whole movie. In other words, he was the little brother that was just kind of tagging along all the time.
How they fight as they're going up the stairs, throwing each other down, little boys.
That he's the little brother that's always in the way, but, you know, he's also your little brother, so you got to stand up for your little brother, you know, help him out, take care of him, so...
Yeah, just all the dynamics there ring true so well. I wonder what it was like back, off screen. I wonder how those adults bonded with those children, because there must have been a bond somehow, because they just really, you know, relax around each other. And the dialogue between them is so well done. It reminds me of The Incredibles. The Incredibles has one of the best written families on screen. It's just the texture of their arguments and the way that they relate to each other. And you know, the mom and the dad, the conflict there, and the kids observing, you know, how they see it, and you know, just a lot of that is really well done. So
because Gavin
Darren McGavin.
Darren McGavin, sorry.
Yeah.
Felt a little bit old for the part, but I mean, he has absolutely nailed it, you know. But he looks-wise, I felt like he was a little bit old for the part. But what I would like to see is like the auditions.
That
would have been fun, because you know he obviously just had a ball with the whole role. I mean.
Oh yeah, he's just his tirades. He can deliver those so well. In the moment, the crescendo of his anger performance was as he just leaned out that broken swing door, swinging on its hinges, and just yells at the Bumpuses and just screams at them, you know, from the depths of his soul. It's the apex of the great tragedy of his existence. He's, you know, he and Ralphie both feel like that, like the entire world is turned against them, and that's the great, terrible moment for him. You know, for Ralphie, it's when he nearly gets shot in the eye.
Yeah.
For him, they both have that story of, you know, everything goes wrong, and you know, he has to bring victory from the jaws of defeat, which he does very well. But you know, for many years, I didn't even know what he was saying as he screamed at the Bumpuses. I remember it many years later, I realized what he was saying, and I'm like, oh, so no wonder my, you know, mom would kind of do her little grunt whenever that particular movies, you can always tell there's been a bad word, you know, even if you're, you know, 6 or 7 and you don't know what the word means, you know, because your mother grunts disapprovingly a few seconds later. And so... Anyway, but that brings us back to Midnight Run.
Yeah.
But I believe I have run out of things to talk about at this point. But
it's a great movie. It's a very American movie, and one that I expect will be around for many years to come.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how it's penetrated the American psyche, because I mean, what some of the, you know, some of the cable channels will play it 24 hours, you know, 24 hours
yeah.
around Christmas, and And while I seriously doubt there's anybody that watches it for 24 hours, I wouldn't put it past them. And the little house that they lived in, you know, that was in the movie is now like a museum to the movie.
A shrine.
Right. I'm sure there's people go up there just to see that, wherever the heck it is. And it's very Midwestern. That's another thing, is it's, you know, there's lots of snow on the ground at Christmas, and it's just a very middle America type of movie.
Yeah, and it really takes you into that time and place too, you know, which is something that I didn't grow up in the 40s, but it made me feel a little bit what it was like to grow
Absolutely.
Up in the 40s.
Yeah.
You know, and there was no gloss over it like a lot of the Hollywood movies at that particular period of time. You would have had, you know, the It's a Wonderful Life, which is Jimmy Stewart was somebody who was very much an everyman and who kind of brought you down to earth. But even then, that was cinematic in a way, in a way that this wasn't. This really brought you down into the mind of a person who was living in that time.
The casting, I don't know how they could have done any better than they did on it. One other cool thing is that Peter Billingsley seems to have turned out okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's no small thing in this day and age.
Yeah, I mean, poor Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah.
Speaking of Home yes. Alone, oh. however, you know, you guys, you know, I'm a believer. It's a fan theory, but I was not on board at first, but I was convinced. It's by Les Lanfear out of the Reform Pub, but I'll put the video in the show notes. It's the theory is this: Kevin McAllister in this movie meets God and gets saved. That is the story of Home Alone. You know, you might be a little bit surprised. You never know.
I know. I was surprised.
Yeah.
I really was surprised. It not that, you know. I mean,
well, poor old Les. He was being very abused in the pub, and
I'm sure.
And then he posted the article, or I mean the video rather, and pretty much everybody was just suddenly like, well, you know, that actually kind of makes a little bit of sense. And it's a you know, I don't normally subscribe to fan theories and think that they're kind of superfluous, and I don't like fan fiction and that sort of thing, which, incidentally, is what I kind of think this new Star Wars movie is. But this may be an exception. I am a believer. At least I want to believe. So.
Of course you do. You're a Twin Peaks type person or an X-Files. I want to believe.
Yeah, I've been reintroducing the family to the X-Files over the last month or two, and
it's been painful.
Yeah, poor Patriarch. He's not a fan, but
you want to slap Mulder.
Yeah, he just doesn't like Mulder for some reason. I don't know.
Julianne Anderson's not so bad, though.
She's the farther you get into the show, the more I become convinced that she's, you know, it's her show. She's just terrific.
Well, she is terrific.
He's good, you know, but he's just. Especially later on, he just kind of becomes her sidekick. He's got terrific comic timing, though. There, we haven't really gotten to the really, really great comedy runs. You know, they would have three or four comedy episodes in a row in season six. Season six, it basically just turns into a romantic comedy. What's going on here? Where are the aliens? You know, there are still aliens, of course, but for three or four episodes, you're kind of wondering. But it's a good show. I've enjoyed it a lot, and it's something that I want to write a lot more about, because I wrote about it for the Weekly Standard. There are lots of things in the show that can be examined from a Christian perspective. You know, lots of different things. It's interesting because there are so very very few shows which I think examine. Just the kind of quality of the conflict of belief and skepticism in such a pure fashion. I mean, that's the plot of pretty much every single episode. It's Mulder's the believer and Scully's the skeptic. You know, she's demanding evidence. And so as the show goes on, they start asking questions about those sort of things. You know, if you can't prove something, you know, then what can you do about it? You know, if there's an injustice that's going on and you can't prove it, then can you still do any good about it? Its sense of spiritual issues is sometimes rather muddled. You know, I don't know if we'll ever do an episode on it, but I'd like to.
On the X-Files?
Yeah, you know. It's you kind of come in and out, and maybe we'll bring the matriarch in for that episode so she can talk a little bit about some of, you know, she's pretty impressed by the monsters, I think. But
they're all kind of the same.
Yeah, to some extent, you know. The themes throughout it shift with...
a couple of the ideas are kind of neat, but they're all... It's all kind of the same thing.
Well, I can't tell you because that would be a spoiler.
Spoiler.
And I know that Scott Kelly, who is our new fan and who's awesome, is watching the X-Files right now, so I can't possibly say anything more.
We have great fans.
We do have great fans. They are the classiest fans. They are fantastic. The best. You know, we have the best people. Definitely. Anyway, oh yeah, and I guess I really should have mentioned this earlier, but we were supposed to do the Return of the King for this episode again, but we never got around to it. Maybe we will someday in the future, but
when
it is not
talk
this day.
Politics?
We talk politics. I mean, we pretty much talk politics almost every episode anyway.
No, we didn't. Yeah.
We didn't do it this time, but you know, we're trying to get back into the swing of things. Normally we do these
Donald
every week.
Donald T. Rump a couple times, but that's it.
Well, yes, I mean you can't escape from Donald T. Rump. But I was gonna say though, we're not doing Return of the King this episode, and I don't know if we're going to return to it because we kind of got burnt out on Lord of the Rings for a while. But in the meantime, we will at least be continuing that story because I'm going to be posting a video blog version of discussing the movie with my grandmother, who I have just completed watching The Lord of the Rings with.
Epic.
It's quite something. She's 82 years old, and she's never watched a fantasy movie in her whole life. She doesn't know how to cope with this, it's an entertaining experience to see her try and fit that into the tropes that with which she is familiar. It's very entertaining, and she loves the movie too. So I've already got 5 minutes, and we're going to finish the movie I think Tuesday, and so I hope to have it edited and posted sometime next week if I have the time, which we'll just have to see how that goes. But anyway, that is, you know, I'll post it on the Pilgrims Podcast YouTube channel, which we do have one. It's just I haven't posted there in ages.
Oh.
Well, it's strictly speaking, it's my...
So we could do like a video version of this?
We could do it, you know. We could.
Man.
But you kind of like...
Then I'd have to get in disguise. I'd have to go in disguise or something.
Like, yeah, I mean... Yeah, you haven't really shown your face.
Yeah, there are limited authorized versions of the patriarch on the interweb.
There is one picture that I have posted of you. Daryl says that you look like James Spader.
I do like James Spader. I noticed that Daryl doesn't have any pictures posted of himself either, right? Not that I've...
Oh.
I mean, just his little icon thing. His little icon picture.
Go down. Yeah, well, the patriarch... You did post a picture.
He probably looks like Tom Cruise or something like that.
Yeah, that's probably it. You know, of course, you have posted several profile images which looked rather like you. Like you had the picture of Lex Luthor for a while there.
Yes, I do have Lex.
You know, Lex Luthor for president.
Like Lex Luthor.
Yeah, that's your Twitter avatar.
Yes.
But avatar profile picture. Anyway.
I've never seen Avatar.
I haven't seen Avatar either the TV show or the movie.
Yay!
But
anyway,
maybe we'll do it sometime so we can pick on the like environmentalists. I'm about sick of environmentalism, I'm afraid, you know, because for Spanish this semester I've had to write about el medio ambiente over and over and over again, and how, you know, the environment is terrible in our area, and it really isn't, you know. So I have to invent things, ways for it to be terrible, which is really tedious. You know, mm-mm. So I'm like, okay, the air and the water. I mean, mm-mm. We can't breathe here. It's just
So higher education is now just making stuff up that sounds good.
Yeah, I mean that's what I've discovered being a homeschooler in college is that's what it's all about.
Yes, giving them what they want. The man, giving the man what he wants.
Of course, I told you my shame, my great shame was my first English class. The teacher required us to turn in a. And this was 3 years ago when I just graduated from high school. And she asked us to write on a theme, which was, I believe in blank, without in the essay saying you don't believe in something else. You know, you can't say I believe in Christianity but not Islam or whatever. You know, so I was sitting there thinking, and it had to be in a sort of an NPR segment format. And I was just sitting there thinking, what would Indy Wilson do? And Indy Wilson is somebody who is has on several occasions turned in rather saucy college essays. And you know what I wanted to do, but which I wimped out, I did not do, was I wanted to write, I believe in objective truth, which means that, you know, I believe in something, which implies that I don't believe in a whole lot of other things. You know, I can't believe in one thing and not believe in, you know, much of, and believe, I can't believe in everything. You know, so it was frustrating me. And of course, you know, I did wimp out and do something really, really insipid, which I can't even admit to. I can't even admit the title on the air, I don't think. You know, I told you what it was, and it was Bill Whittle would be ashamed of me. You know, it was just terrible.
Well,
but yeah. I think I got a pretty good grade, so.
You had to throw your principals under the bus.
Yeah. I have since, I think somewhat redeemed myself, fighting, you know, tooth and nail about Obamacare and sociology. That was a big moment.
That would have been nice to see.
My favorite moment in that, and that reminds me a little bit of Ralphie's dad. You know, that was basically me in that class all semester. It was the Gladiator Wars over every Tuesday and every Thursday morning. I would go in there and have to face the teacher who thought the Koch brothers were behind everything for the last 20 years, and the Obama campaigner on the other side of the room who, you know, thought that every white Southerner was a racist of cake and was secretly a KKK member. And so it was, and here I was, you know, it was my first semester out of engineering. I was being introduced to the great world of liberal arts. and I go in there, and both of them are coming at both fronts, and he had his laptop open all the time, so he was able to Google statistics, and you can win any argument with statistics. So I never had statistics, and I had to argue these big political battles. So it was definitely an...
And we get the blow-by-blow when she came home for supper.
Yeah, you know, I remember some days I was just... And it was really disheartening in some ways, because I could just see how these kids were being shaped by this teacher who had not done her research very well, who didn't know anything about the real world, had been living, you know, just had this really warped and skewed idea of how the economy worked. And I felt like I was, of course, I had to save them from this terrible fate, you know. And, you know, I don't know. But I remember, of course, I did get a few victories in, like the gender gap. That was a big moment. The Obama campaigner on the other side of the room, who was about 26, 27, you know, and he was going on about the evils of the gender gap and how women were being abused and exploited and something. And, you know, I had just gotten, like, the Hills... I had just written out a bunch of statistics on the back of a piece of paper, and it was all about the gender gap, because it was in Times. I even had sources. I had Time Magazine and the Huffington Post, and basically the gender gap. A lot of people say that women are paid what, 78 cents on the dollar,
yeah.
Which is very misleading, because it doesn't take into account things like differences in education level, you know, the hours worked, whether it's, you know, whether women take maternity leave, and they generally take it more than men take paternity leave, you know. So all of those details, things like that, you know. So it's a very misleading statistic, and it's generally not agreed upon by economists. They don't use it. However, the president does. So, you know, I knew there was going to be a gender gap battle in our classroom at some point. And so the day came, And Michael finally brought that one out, and I was ready. it was great. I said, actually, Michael, the gender gap is a myth. When, of course, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, right, you know. I says, the reason why it is a myth is because it doesn't take into account, and you know, I just went down the list, and he looked at me in some shock, and he says, well, you just think women are lazy and stupid. And there was a moment of silence as I tried to deal with that. I was sitting here, a woman, in college, you know, who had turned, he knew I'd turned my assignments in on time, you know, several times. And so I'm like, yes, Michael, I think that. Are you kidding? And, you know, he says, well, what are your sources? You got that from Fox News. And I said, Time Magazine and the Huffington Post. Man, it was a glorious moment. I came home feeling like, you know, I'd won a major award. It was just great.
It's a major award.
Yeah, you know, and I lost many battles that semester, and there were some which were incredibly discouraging, and I would just come home just feeling like the entire American college system is, I just wanted to throw in the towel in. You know, there were some really discouraging moments, especially on the one occasion when we all discussed abortion and people were just so apathetic about it. But, you know, that was the moment. That was there were consolations. You know, some days not every day you get everything you want, but some there are the Christmases occasionally when you get that amazing gift.
When you get that red Ryder BB gun.
You know, the stars align and everything just seems to work out. And, you know, and the capturing the magic of that moment, that's I think, what this movie manages to do really well.
I agree.
So.
It's a great movie.
There was one other occasion, I won't get into it, but I pulled a Ravi Zacharias on the teacher, which was pretty darn awesome. But, you know, yes, I was not a normal child, you know.
Well, I'm glad of it, as are our myriad of listeners.
Yes. Anyway, we had better wrap it up because, you know, it is late, and we've got to watch The X-Files tonight.
Yeah.
But,
So just be sure to email us where Hannah needs to send a resume to, and
yes, because
we'll get right on that.
I would love to write for anybody that, you know, will either pay me or give me some sort of, ability to lead them to my blog, you know, where I have made a whole $10, I think. I still have to wait $90 for the advertisements for them actually to pay me, but I've made $10 on advertisements in 3 years. It's the American way. So, in the meantime, next week, I have no idea what we're doing next week, but, if we're going to be around next week, because
I have the week off. We'll be around.
Okay, well, maybe you can write it, because I want to pitch something to Christianity.
Oh, I could do that.
That you know, that would be the first time, and it's been a year.
Okay.
So, by the way, we've been doing this for over a year now.
Wow.
You know, I was just getting started in the liberal arts program as we were going into this the last time, you know.
That's amazing.
And so, you know, a lot of you have been with us all through that, all through, you know, all the various things that have happened to our family in the last year. You know, it's been crazy, you know, going to Guatemala, coming back, and then the whole, you know, how we very nearly were going to adopt, and then that just kind of fell through. I don't think we really followed up on that with the podcast, but maybe some other occasion. But just there have been so many things that have changed and shifted throughout the year, and we haven't kept up with this as well as we should. But it's really been a pleasure. So.
It has been.
But
those cards and letters coming.
You can find us on Twitter, where you can retweet our many amazing tweets, Growth Boy and Longish, and the Pilgrims Podcast. But if you want to respond to this, you can find us at the blog, on Facebook, or possibly just send us an email at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com, even though I basically never check that email anymore because nobody uses it. So really, just leave a comment on the blog because that's the easiest way for everybody.
Do we have any comments from last time? Oh, yeah, you mentioned it.
We need to figure out a way to do voice calls, because that would be awesome.
That would be fun.
By the way, I was on the Eric Metaxas show like a week ago, and I'm still a little bit starstruck from that. So, yeah.
He doesn't listen to us, though.
No, he should. He should.
Oh, well, and we have one other, hopefully, maybe, new listener out there.
Yes.
Down in Texas.
He's
part of a trifecta, as I recall.
Possibly. I doubt he is still out there. I mentioned the podcast on one of his posts like two, three weeks ago. maybe
we would love to have Scott Ott as our guest on the Pilgrims podcast.
That would be great, because we are both huge fans.
I am a huge fan.
Yeah, we've been listening to Trifecta for ages.
We would come up with a series of tasteful and discreet questions to pose to Mr. Ott. Well, he's a techie guy. We could ask some technical questions and ask him what Bill Whittle has for breakfast.
Ask him embarrassing stories about Bill Whittle. Yeah,
that's right. Now, I have a feeling there are a few that he could probably share.
Yeah. So, anyway, we had better wrap this up. We need an exit line.
Shoot your eye out.
All the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and all the harm I've ever done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be to you all. There's sorrow.